The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratofsky, this week on the show.
So the fact that there's an entrepreneurial visa here in the UK is a significant advantage over what we have in the US, where we've got a very hard limit on the number of people who can come, even the most brilliant people in the world.
As London's Technology Week kicks off, tech grandee Ben Horowitz, one of the founders of web browser Netscape in the early 1990s, talks about the changing nature of the technology business and where the UK is getting it right. Well, that's nice and positive, isn't it? The UK's top counter-terrorism bot explains why mass surveillance of what we do on the web is legal within the UK law. And finally, as all eyes around the world seem to be focused on various conjugations of 22 millionaires running around a grassy field, we'll be discussing the dawn of a new era in goal line technology, which made the French football team cheer and the Honduran team teary. Joining me in the studio this week is Guardian Technology editor Charles Arthur and crack Guardian Tech reporters Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
That was Alex being polite and saying thank you. The rest of you are just rabble. That's what you are. But first, I'm joined by Owen Bocott, the Guardian's legal affairs correspondent. The Director General for Security and Counterterrorism in the UK made an astonishing case for the legality of its mass online surveillance policy this week, claiming it was legal under British law because it was tracking, quote, external communications. Charles Farr, the government's most senior security official, made this claim as justification for its online surveillance activity, the extent of which has, of course, been slowly unveiled as the Edward Snowden leaks have been unraveled. On Tuesday, Farr's statements were published as part of a defense in a case brought to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal by several civil liberties groups. Owen, thank you very much for jumping into the Tech Weekly studio. We appreciate this. Can you clear something up for me in the first instance? What is the Investigatory Powers Tribunal?
The IPT, as it's known in legal circles, is it's like a court, which deals with complaints about the way the intelligence services operate and the way in which surveillance is carried out by government agencies. Particularly under RIPA, which is the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act.
We're going to get into RIPA in just a second, but first, tell me about the context in which Charles Farr's statement was published.
But following the Snowden revelations last year, a number of civil liberties groups, Privacy International, Amnesty, Liberty, lots of others, combined together and started taking complaints to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, alleging that the activities of the intelligence services in mass surveillance were illegal, and challenging how it's carried out, which formally starts a legal action. And so the government has had to reply. And this very lengthy, it's 48 pages long, document by Charles Farr, who's the senior security advisor, tries to set out why the government believes its policy is perfectly legitimate. And in the course of it, it draws a very fine distinction between what are external communications and what are internal communications. And it says basically that internal communications require individual warrants to intercept anybody's communications. And most people probably thought that operated for any communications they had, and that if someone was going to listen in to you or intercept what you're doing, the government would need to get a warrant. But there's a distinction drawn by Farr. He says that under Section 8, brackets 4 of RIPA, the surveillance regime, they can carry out surveillance on any external communications and they don't need individual warrants for it. They seem to be happy to define external communications in a very broad way and define it as by which platform you use rather than necessarily who you intend to communicate with at the end, although it doesn't seem to be slightly at odds whether you're using email or not. It's I may not have understood it in full, but these things will be argued over for several days the IPT.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is, say, you know, Facebook or any of the other services have UK subsidiaries. They have, you know, there is a Facebook UK, there is a Google UK. So am I still not communicating with something that is on the same soil as me?
It's not clear exactly whether it follows the legal definition or the technical reality of which ways the packets of information stream. One of the odder aspects in the very lengthy statement that Farr has submitted is that whilst he accepts that PRISM, one of the interception systems operated also by the Americans, and which the Americans have publicly acknowledged, does exist, he says, therefore, the Americans have acknowledged it, and therefore I can acknowledge it, I being Charles Farr. Charles Farr says he can acknowledge it. There's also a statement there saying that he's not prepared to confirm whether tempora exists or not, because so the whole thing is sort of being taken on a theoretical basis anyway.
And tempora is what?
It's one of the interception programs that they've used, that the agencies, GCHQ and others, have used to carry out mass surveillance on the web. And we know about that because of the leaks from Edward Snowden. But because Farr says, because it hasn't been officially confirmed by some of the allies, that he has to fall back on the old policy of neither confirm nor deny.
That was Owen Bocott. Now, Charles, can you explain a little bit more about how Charles Farr justified the UK's online interception policy?
So the justification is that if you're communicating with someone outside the UK, then your communication is travelling over the internet and it finishes up in a place that's outside the UK. So the rules that require them to get a warrant for looking at things inside the UK don't apply. So they can simply say, well, it's a communication outside the UK. We don't need to get a warrant from anyone. So we'll just go and have a look at it.
But say I'm communicating with you via email, right? Or via a social network, right?
It's slightly different if the two people who are doing the communication are inside the UK. If they're inside the UK, then they're covered by the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which means that they have to get a warrant. Though quite how difficult it is to get a warrant is not very clear, but one suspects it's not that hard if you're GCHQ to get a warrant to look at these things. So if it's a communication that goes, even if it travels outside the UK as part of its meanderings across the internet, if it starts in the UK and finishes in the UK, then it's covered under RIPA. However, if it starts in the UK, finishes outside, or, as I understand it, if it starts in the UK and is shared outside, so like a Google document shared with people outside, then they can say, well, hey, it's, you know, it lands in another place, it lands outside the UK, therefore we're allowed to tap it. And the tapping, as we understand it, goes on through Tempora, which is the system for looking at cables, contents of what goes through internet cables as they sort of either land or emerge from the sea, you know, around the coast of Britain.
Does the problem also not consist of, you know, say I have my email account registered in the UK, but I'm on one of my business travel situations and I'm outside the UK at that moment, so essentially who knows when I'm in the country or not? Or I'm just a bit confused, because surely I could be using a VPN. There's all kinds of ways around that you don't necessarily know where in the world a person is that you're communicating with them. So does that thrown into the mix when it comes to this legal wormhole?
I would imagine that it's done on IP address. You know, that if you're trying to discover whether someone's inside the UK, whether the two recipients, the two people in the conversation, are inside the UK for the purposes of RIPA, then you look at the IP address. And if you've got a VPN, that surfaces at some place or other. You know, it might be you're in the US coming into and your sort of VPN surfaces in the UK, in which case it would come under RIPA. If you're in the UK and your VPN emerges in the US and you communicate with someone in the UK, then I suspect that actually for the purposes of RIPA, it's outside. They can basically just tap it as they like.
And that's the issue, isn't it? It's simply that it goes outside the jurisdiction of RIPA.
Exactly, that it falls outside the jurisdiction of RIPA, and therefore, it's sort of their argument is, well, we need to be able to look at all this stuff for the purposes of intelligence gathering, and it's hardly as if, you know, the governments in other countries which might be hostile to us or might be harbouring people who, you know, have terrorist intentions are going to give us a warrant to go and listen into their computer communications.
Alex?
I mean, interestingly, I've already had companies coming at me with press releases jumping off the back of this. A Brighton-based search engine, Mojik, is now loudly trumpeting the fact that its servers are in the UK. So if you're doing a search on Mojik, unlike a search on Google, Ripper prevents the government from eavesdropping on you.
The UK government
from eavesdropping on you. But then the US government was going to eavesdrop you on you anyway because you're not American. But I mean,
I've got two passports. What legal issues am I dealing with? Right now?
Everyone watches you. But it's a piecemeal solution. But you know, in the short term, it really is the easiest way to take this information and use it to make yourself more secure. Just find out who has British servers and consider using them for a bit.
This whole thing is such a sort of miasma. It's so incredibly confusing for the general public. How on earth are they to understand this? And in fact, Home Secretary Theresa May weighed in on this earlier this month when she suggested that the problem with online surveillance is not that it's happening, but just that people didn't really buy into the idea of British online surveillance. And specifically, they didn't buy into what was colloquially known as the Snooping Bill, i.e. the Draft Communications Data Bill, which, Charles, I believe she's intending to bring up again before the next election.
It'd be quite something if she managed to get it through, though. I mean, you know, it is a zombie government. There's not really time for anything to pass unless they were to do it in what's called the wash-up, the period between when Parliament said it's going to dissolve and while it's still just about working and the election when it actually is broken up. So one would sort of hope they wouldn't bring it in during the wash-up, because that's what happened with the Digital Communications Bill, which has been such a mess and which has basically gone nowhere in the past 5 years.
But in addition, this is now a world post Snowden. This is now a world in which we are familiar with terms like PRISM and
Tempura,
which I was not familiar with until earlier today, but now I know about it. I thought it was just some fried vegetables.
This one's spelled with an O, rather.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I saw that. But how is the public going to respond to the reintroduction in conversation of the draft communications
data? It's really hard to judge people's reaction to this. It varies a lot by country. So in the UK, people seem a bit indifferent to the idea of the government reading their emails and all that sort of stuff. In Germany, it's a very strong reaction. They really do not like it. In the US, it's sort of a bit in between. It's more than the UK, less than Germany. And I think you can get a measure of it by looking at the stats on search engines such as startpage.com, xquick.com, DuckDuckGo. You know, those are the ones which actually give you an idea. And for them, the traffic is rising. It's not a gigantic rise. They're not sort of challenging Google or even Bing just yet. But they are bigger than they were a year ago.
Alex?
It's obviously the slightly snarky thing to say, but perhaps part of the reason why Americans are less concerned than Germans is because the American response, the American governmental response to all of this has been, don't worry, Americans, you're not being spied on as much as everyone else.
Well, exactly. And of course, everybody is aware of the fact that they're continuing to spy on them, whether it's on their mobile phones. Yeah. And in fact, how do different devices play into all of this? Mobile phones is something that has been in the media in terms of snooping. Not snooping, but surveillance. So we're not just talking about accessing web or accessing data content through our traditional means, which was desktops, laptops, etc. What then happens when you throw different technologies into the mix?
Well, when you have mobile phones, then there are many other ways to tap them. They're far more active. They can gather far more information from them. And you know, a lot of this was rehearsed in all the stories that were written around the Snowden disclosures last year. But you know, the security agencies love mobile phones when other people are using them because they can exploit all sorts of weaknesses, you know, yet undescribed. Many of the things that came up last year, I think, were actually quite old in terms of weaknesses that were found, and the phones since then have they were talking about sort of weaknesses that existed in 2008, 2009. Mobile phone security has improved quite a lot since then, I think, but still one suspects there's lots of weaknesses that still exist. And the fact is still that actually the data that you use still travels over, you know, over the internet, and so is still tappable in the same way.
For more on this story, go to theguardian.com/technology. This week, a technological milestone in the history of the World Cup tournament was reached. Sam, it involved lots of happy France supporters and some pretty unhappy Hondurans. Tell us more.
That's right. Finally, we have goal line technology in play at the World Cup, something we've been desperately seeking for best part of, I don't know, 10 years or so, something like that.
It's astonishing that it hasn't been in play already, because certainly most of the other sports that I'm familiar with are, you know, for example, Charles, tennis has had Hawkeye technology for a long time.
At
volleyball.
At least 20
cricket.
Years.
Yeah, exactly. So why has it taken so long for football to get this?
So it's been a debate over taking out the human element. You know, football and the refereeing system is a touchy subject. Some think it would take away the spirit of the game. Others thought it was going to be inaccurate, not being able to track the ball correctly. I mean, let's go down to brass tacks. What it actually does is just track whether the ball has crossed the goal line. It's not, as some people think, an automated decision. It doesn't bounce over the line and go, beep, goal. What it does is it sends a message to the referee's watch to indicate that the ball has crossed the line and that it should be a goal. The referee then makes the decision. Some of the other systems proposed were actually just video replays, because you can often see it in a video replay, but that takes ages. Now, the definition of the goal line technology that's actually allowed to be used has to send this alert to the referee via an encrypted secure line so that nobody can mess with it.
I can only imagine it's like on a jawbone and somebody gets, you know, their heart rate up or something like that.
I kid you not. I mean, the max match fixing thing, whole thing, blimey, it could spiral out of control. So anyway, encrypted in under 1 second. So it's quite fast. So there are essentially two ways to do it, or two ways in practice that have been tested and some have been approved for use. The one currently in use is a bit like Hawkeye, so it's a camera-based system. So it's called Goal Control, that's the one in use in the World Cup. In the Premier League for the 2013-2014 season, it was Hawkeye. Essentially, they work the same way. It's 14 cameras dotted around the stadium, seven each pointed at the goal, and they both track the position and triangulate the position of the ball in real time. And so, therefore, as long as enough cameras can see it, and pretty much, I think it only requires two or three to be able to see it, which is hence why there's seven dotted all over the place, it can see whether the ball's crossed the line or not, even for a fraction of a second.
That's quite interesting in terms of the design of the ball as well, I can imagine. Because, say, you know, you have the old traditional football that I recall from the girls' sport in the United States, which is, you know, obviously round but has the black and the white on it. Mm. That would probably confuse a lot of these camera systems. And so, therefore, the actual physical design of the ball has to be adapted to this technology.
Well, that was one of the reasons why a secondary system was developed, which instead of based on a camera system, it's based on a magnetic field. So there are two competing systems, one produced in partnership with Adidas, who makes the ball. So inside the ball, there's a tiny little sensor suspended directly in the center to protect it from impact, because these balls are kicked very, very hard. They travel over 100 miles an hour in some cases. And it detects when it crosses a threshold in the goal. But that's not the one that's currently in use at the World Cup. The cameras are so good and so high speed that actually the design of the ball, as long as it's, you know, visible to the cameras, the computer systems are sophisticated enough to pick it out.
Could I just point out, you know, that the Cyclops system was introduced at Wimbledon in 1980. And that was dealing with balls which were travelling 120 miles an hour or faster. And that was just judging the service line, which is when the ball's travelling its fastest. Yeah, it's infrared. Dead simple. I mean, yeah, it's taken football, which has got bazillions of pounds going into it, 25 years nearly, to you know, just about get near to the point where it's almost at this point that tennis was in the generation before it's got to now.
So do you think, Sam, that this is just to do with people's comprehension or understanding how this technology works? Because as far as I know, there was a bit of controversy around the first issue. I think, Charles, basically what we're saying is that football commentators aren't nearly as quick as the tennis commentators from the 1980s.
Well, put it this way. FIFA's currently looking at how the replays work for the goal. So, yes, the first goal given in the World Cup by the system, indicated by the system, was in the France-Honduras game on Sunday. And the system worked perfectly. Don't get me wrong, it worked great, and as far as most people were concerned, there was no confusion, because the replay showed that basically that the ball hit the post first, and that was declared no goal. Obviously, it bounced out, so the system showed that as a no goal result. Great, it works. It then bounced off and hit the keeper and then went across the line, and that was shown as a goal result. Anyway, on the big screen, I guess in the excitement, they saw the first no goal result and then went, yeah, and didn't watch as the replay continued and it bounced off the keeper and then went in. And that confused some of the commentators who then sought to seek controversy in something that was not controversial.
There you go, Charles. That's why the Oculus or Cyclops. Optimus or Cyclops or whatever it is, Hawkeye. Was
older listeners may remember Ilya Stasi getting down on his hands and knees and trying to argue a call with Cyclops. And John McEnroe similarly, you know.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all.
John McEnroe saying, you know, I'm not paranoid, but that thing knows me.
I quite like, though, that, you know, being Sarky, yes, tennis was 30 years ahead of football, but now football is the one that has the that automatically gives the results to the machine. Tennis still has the slightly anachronistic thing of you only get a few calls. You know, we can't tax the robot too much. Can't ask it to decide on every single call.
No, but it's a strategy thing, you know. Where they get three disputes per set.
Yeah.
And that's about strategy, about
you could also just correctly call every ball and not have to deal with the weird strategy thing that's been introduced in recent years. And
yeah, but it turns tennis into poker, doesn't it? You know? I mean, that was the thing that McEnroe turned it into a completely strategy game about when is he going to blow up over a line call? And that was entirely his thing, which was to put his opponent off their game.
It was amusing, though.
It was. Very bouncy tennis rackets, I recall, from watching as a kid. Well, you can read all of Sam's coverage on this story at theguardian.com/technology. London's role as a tech startup hub and a focus for investment in the technology sector was underlined this week when our gracious mayor, Boris Johnson, welcomed his former New York counterpart, Michael Bloomberg, to launch the annual festival that is London Tech Week. Alex, you went along to witness this event.
Yeah, I feel I should paint a slight picture of just what Boris welcoming his former New York counterpart, Michael Bloomberg, actually entails. What we had was a very, very odd photo call. Boris and Bloomberg, the press were told, would be competing to build a computer in under 3 minutes. This using a new Raspberry Pi-based kit by a company, a British company, obviously a London company, called Kano, which essentially is little more than a pre-built Raspberry Pi that you plug a few wires in and you have a simple Linux box running. What Boris and Bloomberg competing turns out to mean is Boris and Bloomberg on quote-unquote teams with two school children from Holloway School on each team competing. What this means is Boris and Bloomberg standing watching some school children build a computer, Boris getting sort of into it and, you know, huffling and puffling as Boris does, and Michael Bloomberg standing there completely stony still, not saying a word, watching children building a computer, and then when they were done, sort of nodding once and leaving. Not a word was uttered by Mayor Bloomberg once in this whole co-launch with Boris. And then Boris proceeded to answer questions about Uber and about the ECJ and Iraq, because that's what you wanted a Tech Week event.
Well, actually, we do have a clip of Boris Johnson, Mayor Johnson. I've never actually heard of him described as Mayor Johnson before, but a clip of Boris Johnson talking about the need for London not to fall behind when it comes to infrastructure and enabling big startups. So here he is.
You've got to make sure that, for instance, you have really good broadband provision across London, and we're looking at that. But the other thing, there's no reason for hubris when you consider that although we've got the biggest tech sector anywhere in Europe here in London, we've got an incredible range of people coming to London, they want to live here, they want to work here, they set up companies here, we haven't yet produced the kind of knockout multi-billion pound business of the kind they produced in Silicon Valley. We've got to work out what it is. Is it a certain British diffidence about making billions of pounds? Is it that we don't have the right kind of kick-ass business people here enough? Or is it that the banks, the venture capital industry aren't as imaginative and as proactive as they could be? We need to think about all the reasons why we're not yet knocking the rest of the planet out of the park. It was certainly the biggest centre in Europe by a long way.
That was Mayor Boris Johnson, London Mayor Boris Johnson, obviously, talking about why London has not produced a tech giant like Google. Alex, what can you tell me about the sort of general overview of what's happening in London Tech Week?
Well, I mean, it's being pitched as, you know, the technology equivalent of London Fashion Week. That doesn't quite work because, of course, the thing that Fashion Weeks have, firstly, is a lot of cool people
pretty
in town.
People.
But also, you know, if you're a fashion house, you save some big announcements, you save some big shows for London Fashion Week. London Tech Week does not yet have anything of that sort. We're not having companies coming over and announcing new products here. It's currently a slightly glorified conference. It's a good conference, and there's a lot of events happening around London that are quite interesting to go to, but it's not the sort of thing which will dominate the press year on year if it carries on being just like this. Hopefully, you know, in 2-3 years, it will have grown to such an extent that, you know, Apple feels the need to ship Tim Cook over to do a key. It's not going to happen.
But are they essentially looking to bring the South by Southwest interactive vibe to the UK? Or are there other places around the UK where that might actually be a better sell?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is part of the thing. I think they are hoping that South by Southwest Interactive, I think that's the goal, that, you know, for a week, London will be full of movers and shakers, and that just the talk of the tech scene for the next month or so will be about what happened in London. I think you're right, South by Southwest, part of the reason why that's so influential is that the conference is dominant in Austin for that period. That's never going to happen in London. No single thing can dominate London. I guess the Olympics, you know, if London Tech Week grows to the size of the 2012 Olympics, maybe then it will be the talk of the town. But no, until then, it's this slightly oddly disjointed thing swallowed up by a city that's too big for it. There's interesting stuff. There's a Boatcoin Expo. Some Bitcoin people are getting on a boat on Friday.
What is Boatcoin?
Some Bitcoin people are getting on a boat on Friday, and they're going to go around London on a boat talking about Bitcoin.
That's a bit like Dork Boat, which is like Dorkbot, but it's on a boat.
There you go.
It was good.
Boat-based conferences.
Yes, quite. You're in transit, and you're trapped as well. Sam, you literally tears are rolling down your face over there. Why do you find this? Why do you find London Tech Week, the concept of London Tech Week, so ridiculous?
It's not ridiculous. It's just the grand hope of the thing. I mean, you've got to start somewhere. And, you know, to be honest, there are some interesting stuff, and I am going to go to them. Whether there'll be any real news, and that's the issue. Reporting on just an event doesn't really cut it these days. You kind of have to have something happen for somebody to write about it.
But compare, for example, the main computer games events that happen in the US, right? You have E3, which is all about the big launches, which recently happened. But then you also have something like GDC, the Game Developers Conference, which is more an opportunity for people to get together. It's quite conferencey, but it's also quite thought-provoking. Do we need to have events that are all about, you know, here's the big launch, here's big social media company X, you know, causing people to not be able to get taxis, or, you know, opening up offices or whatever? Do we need that?
A lot of it depends on what we is. As a hard-nosed newspaper reporter, yes, we do. It's really quite hard to report on thought-provoking.
I'm a columnist.
But no, I think, you know, the success of London Tech Week will be measured in it won't be measured in us and newspaper reporters. It'll be measured in what the London technology scene feels like coming out of it. If this feels like a moment when internally people have come together, links have been made that might not have been made otherwise, there's a general sense of one London tech scene. And that's a scene which, you know, people talk about it, but it's not strong. There's a Silicon Roundabout scene, but a greater London tech scene doesn't really exist to the best of my knowledge. And also, if all of those inner London companies are helped by jetting in movers and shakers from around the world, then yeah, this could justify its existence. If after it everyone goes back and carries on life as normal, having been to a few interesting talks, I think they'll struggle to get as much excitement about it next year.
And just to put you on the spot, you mentioned that there are a couple of things that you're interested in going to see. What are they?
One of them is, it's something that I'm interested in going to see, but I can't, so I'm sending Sam in my stead.
Other than the boat coin.
Nesta, which is a UK organisation which looks at sort of the intersection of technology and economics, is discussing A long obsession of mine, robots in the economy. Essentially, are robots going to take our jobs? They've got some fantastic speeches, some fantastic speakers. Francis Coppola of Piera and Isabel Kaminska of the FT will be there. They're going to, I think it will have been done by the time this airs, sadly, so I'm sure they will have said fascinating things on the subject of algorithms, machines, and the new economy.
And Sam, do you have anything that's on your dance card?
Well, the Nesta thing is very interesting. One of the other things that I'm not sure I'm going to get time to go to, perfect world I would, is there's a AI in the brain talk, which is kind of simulating the brain with big data. It's much more aimed at academic. I think it's hosted in one of the London universities. But it sounds fascinating. I mean, there are a lot of these fascinating talks. And actually, if you look at the talks and schedule, quite a lot of them are in the evening. So they're obviously geared up for networking. It's a great networking.
It sounds like it's a good opportunity just to go and have an umbrella under which some interesting technology things happen. And given that, you know, there is such an emphasis this year on things like the Year of Code, we've also got the Science Museum opening up a new wing later this year that's all about technology. You know, it seems to me like this is a pretty good time for people to be going and thinking about tech in a different way rather than just consumer. So if you're interested, then head over to theguardian.com/technology for all of our information on London Tech Week, or you can head over to londontechnologyweek.co.uk and find out all of the things that are happening this week. It is the perennial question. What does the center of the technology universe, Silicon Valley, think of our technology operations here in the UK? Are we small fries or world leaders? Are we mice or men and women who make waves? This week, Charles had the chance to speak with Ben Horowitz, British-born superpower VC, about the UK tech scene. Charles, who is Ben Horowitz? When we spoke about this before, you were very proud about the fact that he was British-born, but he was actually raised in California.
Yeah, British-born, but exported to the US, where he began work as a program manager in a little company called Netscape, which revolutionized the way that people thought about the internet, because it really was the first commercial web browser client, following on from the Nixon Mosaic, which had come from the University of Illinois in Champaign. And Netscape went big. He got some money from the IPO. He then went and set up a company called LoudCloud, which was split into two. Part of it was sold to EDS. Another part was sold on to a private company. And he's now set up some years ago, he set up a company with Mark Andreessen, who's one of the people from Netscape. And so they are the people who are behind Andreessen Horowitz, which is a venture capital company, but with a twist, because they don't do it in the normal way where they just give people a bundle of money and say, yeah, go and make lots of money. They're much more of what's thought of as a sort of a full service VC company. They do more around it than simply, as I say, handing out wads of money. They actually do analysis. They bring people in. They, in effect, sort of rent people out. And he thinks a lot about what's going to be coming next, because that's what VCs have to do. And having seen the way that the internet has developed and the way that the money has ebbed and flowed, he's in a good position to think about the people who are coming in next. So I first asked him about his early years at Netscape.
So Netscape, of course, was the company that kind of brought the internet to the world, essentially, but ended up in a very competitive market with Microsoft because the internet was basically a threat to the Windows franchise. And ultimately, the good news, I think, for the world was the internet won that war. The bad news for us at Netscape is, in the short term, Microsoft put tremendous pressure on us and we were forced to sell the company to AOL. But it was an amazing time. It was a company that, you know, its whole lifespan was only 4 years. And it was an amazing 4 years. We went from zero to 3,000 employees in 2 years. And wow. Then, had all kinds of trials and tribulations. But
what,
it was
what was
really
your role
exciting. So I started as a product manager. And then I eventually became kind of the person who ran the server products, or kind of most of the server products and the security products. And it was really, it was a great time that we invented so many things in such a short span. So Netscape invented JavaScript, it invented cookies, it invented SSL. So like huge parts of the internet came out of like a tiny period of time. And so the impact of that company was great. LoudCloud, which you know eventually became Opsware, and we sold we sold the LoudCloud part of the business to EDS, and then we sold Opsware to Hewlett Packard years later, is kind of the classic company that made it through the bubble. So we founded that in 1999, which was probably the worst time in the history of the world to start a technology company.
I don't know. I think April 2001 was quite a bad one. But, yeah.
Well, at least then you knew what you were into. So 99 was the worst because you got the money and then you were basically out there to dry. So we went public, you know, 18 months into the company, which I don't recommend. And it started out as kind of the original cloud computing company. So it was cloud computing probably 8 years before it made sense to build that company. And then, you know, with the bubble bursting, we were sort of, you know, held very much in the lurch in that a lot of our customers were new companies. And so we had to do some, you know, very difficult maneuvering in the public markets to kind of change the business and get it to a good outcome. But it was a very character building experience for sure. And, you know, had a happy ending, but a very, very rough ride.
And how has the technology landscape developed, you know, since you were in Netscape, since you first started there? I mean, you know, we're talking about nearly 20 years since it started up. The technology landscape, the computing power has increased enormously. Connectedness has increased enormously. What are the key elements that you see as being the drivers now of technology change and social change?
Yeah, well, it really is completely different in that when we started Netscape, there really weren't any consumer technology companies. So, you know, you kind of say, well, was the PC a consumer device? Kind of, but for very weird consumers, right, like hobbyists. No regular people had them. They were kind of for business. And then there were, you know, there were some technology companies that were games, but other than that, it wasn't. There weren't like a lot of consumer companies. There were no consumer skill sets kind of in the technology world. Now it's completely different, with everyone having a computer in their pocket, and then you know, on the back end, the advent of cloud computing enabling people to kind of very, very easily develop software. These things are really, really, really different than when we started. And that makes for, one, a different kind of company and just a much broader set of opportunities. So in the old days, if you're a technology company, you sold technology products. You sold disk drives. You sold networking devices. You sold, you know, software, like complex software for businesses to run like SAP. You know, now there are things like Dropbox and Twitter and Facebook and so forth, which are for, like, regular people to use. And so the markets have really expanded. And the scale of it has expanded. So, you know, the Facebook getting to 1 billion users and $10 billion in revenue in 10 years just was against the business laws of physics when I began. And the really exciting thing is that we're at the beginning. We're at the beginning of what can you do with this platform of cloud computing and mobile computing, you know, for the next 10 years. And I think that's going to be, you know, really, really exciting from, you know, from the company building and venture capital standpoint. And it also is we're in a world where the inventor can run their own company, which we think is a great model.
What are the particular technology? I mean, obviously, you mentioned the smartphone, the computer in people's pockets. What sort of elements of these capabilities, you know, the cloud and the smartphone, what are the things that you see as really pushing stuff forward? I mean, is it being able to send messages between people or pictures, or are there new business models to be created out of these things that you're seeing people derive?
Well, you know, almost any business would be different if you assumed that everyone had a computer in their pocket. I mean, the Guardian's business is already changing to that extent. There was a large kind of protest 2 days ago here in London.
There was the Uber and the cabs.
Uber and the cabs. And right, you know, in the kind of previous world, to acquire the knowledge, it's a 3-year, very intensive program. The drivers take a lot of pride in that. But if you were to build that company today, you would assume that there were GPS and Google, and you might take a different approach. And so, you know, it's a rethinking of almost how we do every single thing in the world. Then there are kind of even bigger advances and more exciting things. So because you have a supercomputer in your pocket, there are possibilities with things like health that are much different. For example, we're invested in a company called Ubiome, which measures your microbiome and sequences the DNA of the bacteria in your gut. And, you know, they're in the early days of it, but because you have a supercomputer in your pocket, you know, in the same way that you used to have to memorize the maps and otherwise you would get lost, and nobody gets lost today. You know, even I don't get lost and I have no sense of direction. Today, if you get sick, you really don't know what's wrong with you, and you may even go to the doctor, and the doctor may figure it out or the doctor may not. But 5 years from now, if you have a smartphone, you will never not know what's wrong with you. It will be like the equivalent of being lost. And that, you know, that's just a really exciting possibility. And there's a lot of work going into companies like that and ideas like that. And so, you know, I think that from an imagination standpoint, it's hard to even get your head around 10% of the things that might happen.
Now, you're over here in the UK. You were at the Founders Forum yesterday. As I understand it, you've been advised, invest in the beer-drinking countries, not the wine-drinking countries.
Yes.
I mean, are there interesting companies you're seeing in the UK? What's the, you know, and what's the temperature between the US and Silicon Valley and the UK? How does it look to you?
Yeah, so I would say the UK has gotten, like, very exciting, you know, since I was here last. I mean, you know, in previous trips to the UK, they're kind of like, it's like oil and gas and financials. And then there's like eight guys building startups. That was it in the past. Now, the entrepreneurial environment has a lot of momentum, as well as some very interesting policy support. So the fact that there's an entrepreneurial visa here in the UK is like a significant advantage over what we have in the US, where you literally, you know, we've got a very hard limit on the number of people who can come, even the most brilliant people in the world, and work in these companies. So that's quite exciting, and I think a very kind of positive indicator of the future. Yeah, and as a result, I think the companies are getting much more interesting. There's a company being built by the one of the former people at Skype. We were an investor in Skype out of Estonia. Mm. One of the early employees there is building a company called TransferWise, which very clever, quite exciting, and uses some of his particular knowledge and experience that he's got being a second-time entrepreneur and building it as an example. So I think there's quite a lot of promise.
So if there were one piece of advice you were giving to someone looking to build their British company up and make it really valuable, not necessarily with a view to selling, but, you know, just with a view to being the best that they can, what would it be? What are the things to focus on?
Well, I think that one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, in the same way that you're building a startup, kind of the UK is a startup entrepreneurial environment compared to, say, Silicon Valley, like, which is kind of the incumbent big one. So the thing that I would, you know, stay away from would be things that Silicon Valley is good at. Like, so I wouldn't build a new networking equipment company, I don't think, in the UK, because I think the level of expertise that you'd have available to you versus the corresponding company would be challenged. So you definitely want to do something brand new. And I think taking advantage of, you know, one of the things that is illegal in the US is stem cell research. So if you think about things like life sciences, it's very difficult to build a new life sciences company in the United States due to the regulatory regime, which has probably gone, you know, beyond safety to nuttiness. And, you know, to the extent that both the UK entrepreneurial community, you know, great universities for that like Cambridge, and the UK government can work together, there's great opportunities to build the biggest companies in the world in fields like that. So kind of taking, you know, as a startup, you would never take Google head on in search or Facebook head on in social networking with the exact same product. And I think in the same way, you want to kind of get to places that are Silicon Valley is bad at innovating and would be more promising for a really giant outcome.
Ben Horowitz, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. This is great.
And that's all we have on the podcast this week. For more on all these stories as they unfold, head to theguardian.com/technology. Thanks to our tech team and to our producer, Jason Fitz. I'm Alex Kratosky. We are back next week. We'll see you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.